Let's move to the first line of chapter 7. Vayomer Adonai el Moshe, re'e netaticha Elohim lefaro, ve'aron achicha yiyed nevi'echa. It's a big line. Adonai said to Moses, see, I place you in the role of God to Pharaoh, with your brother Aaron as your prophet. Now, that's not necessarily the way we see it later. We see Moses as a prophet. We see Aaron as a priest. And yet here, he's saying, you will be God to Pharaoh. And before we get to the hardening of the heart and all that kind of stuff, because you see just above, you get Moses appealed to the Lord, like, come on, I'm of impeded speech. How then should Pharaoh heed me? So, I mean, it's perfect for what Dina said. How me be present at Hadassah? Be me in charge of that. I'm of impeded speech. You know, like that's exactly what we say. Nothing has changed in 3,000 years. And then it's like, and not only that, but you're going to be God to him. Now, I love this line. I think it's, I'll give you my interpretation, or maybe I should ask you, it's a hard one just to jump on to me. I mean, I needed to think about it for a while. What is it? You could say it's a little bit like what we just said, which is he's almost saying all the way up front, right after Moses says, I cannot speak, God's almost prefacing devarim, which is, in other words, like own it. Like one way of saying it is, you will hide behind me. Well, God told me, you know, it's really not good what you're doing with the Israelites and the Jews. They're my people. And I don't think slavery, God says slavery isn't right. And God says this isn't the way to treat people. And God, it's saying, like, you're going to go, like, you got to own the message. Like I said, I don't mind when people disagree on the message, but I like it when people own it and say, you know, he wants him to say, like, Martin Luther King style, Pharaoh, you know, it's like, what you are doing is wrong. Let my people go. And if you don't, there will be consequences, because cosmic consequences happen when you go against the will of God, you know, especially the moral law. And so I see part of that already happening in the first line after impeded speech, which is God. He's like, own it. Don't be, oh, I am just the prophet who is speaking words on behalf of someone else. So I see that as a big part of it. Any other interpretations of what it would mean that Moses is in the role of, does it say in the role of Nitaticha? I'm appointing, in other words, Nitaticha, I'm appointing you Elohim. I'm appointing you God, Lefaro, for Pharaoh. It doesn't say in the role of, but you will be God to Pharaoh. So that's one way. Okay, I'm going to give another interpretation. Maybe I'll inspire. Totally different. It goes like this. This is one I got from Rabbi Bradley Shavit Artson in L.A., the head of the seminary. If you want to tell someone what religion is, standing on one foot. We all know Hillel's, don't do unto others what you find obnoxious when it's done to you. But everyone should have their kind of epitaph, their one-liner. I've got mine, I won't share it with you right now. It ends my sin list. One great one-liner to sum up all of religion is basically to say, and I agree with it, in every situation in your life, you have to be the big one in the room. I think that pretty much hits it. I mean, you know, like maybe I can do that on Yom Kippur and we can all like get to break early. You know, like, I mean, I can give a 1-hour sermon, I give a 1/2-hour sermon, but in our days of short attention spans, it nails everything. In every situation in your life, you have to be the big one in the room. In the parenting, in the driving, because, you know, I get road rage. You know, people are always taking my spot. I was waiting for that. With your spouses or with your coworkers, even with a boss. With every single situation, someone has to be the adult in the room. And if you can think of that before you react to anything, it'll probably tell you how to act in that situation, right? I do it with my kids all the time. I'm crazy about Ziva, our youngest. She reminds me of Lynn. I'm just crazy about her. And she really gets on my nerves. She's really been pushing us lately. And she's always like performing and kind of, you could call it, as Lynn says, attention seeking. You could call it, as I do, she's just expressing herself. And so, like, it's hard. You know, if a child is always like, oh, they're always, you know, they're, it's always like, give me a break, you know. And what I say to myself always is, someone's got to be the adult in the room. And in this one, it's an easy answer who it has to be. It has to be us, right? You can't say, like, the four-year-old's going to be the adult. So that I just say, like, what does it mean in this moment to be the big one in the room? And it helps me be my best self. Like, I'm just like, in this moment, being the big one in the room is I want to enjoy every moment of this. And I'm going to ask Lynn to go play a game with them so I can take a nap. No, that's not the big one in the room. Yesterday, I asked Lynn to be the big one in the room so I could take a nap. So thank God that I have another. But it really almost always tells me how to react. Someone delivered a message to me yesterday that I'd been a bad rabbi and let them down because of something. And it was incredibly unjust, incredibly unjust. And I just wanted to be like, you don't even know that situation, like that you think you know something about, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I just had to, who's going to be the big one in the room? Someone's making one of these stupid accusations. You don't even know the facts. You think you know. You want to be self-righteous. And I'm like, well, that's not a very adult way to be. So someone's got to be the big one in the room. And so I'm like, okay, thank you for delivering your message. And you can know that you've delivered your message. It was a childish thing to deliver, but I'll take it from you. In other words, I could have said, which I really wanted to say, which is you got to stand up and be an adult. And you don't get to pass the buck. A lot of people like to take their buck. I'm a self-righteous person. Someone should do something about the environment. Someone should visit that person. Someone should call that person. Someone should, you know, blah, someone should get rid of the weeds. So I get rid of the weeds. And in the congregational meeting, everyone makes fun of me for being the landscaper. So, you know, like, but to me, that was like being the big person. The big person in the room is, I've watched these weeds grow over and over and over and over again. So I'm going to buy, and I don't want to tell you what it is because those who are scared of chemicals will get angry at me. And I killed the weeds, you know. And then I can't walk anywhere because the bushes are hitting me. And I could be like, oh, no, I should complain to this person. I should do that. Someone should be in charge. You know, people should take responsibility. But no, I bring in a chainsaw and I cut them down. And, and Darren, if you ever want to join me, I could use another foot. So, like, the stuff I couldn't reach because, you know, I was thinking about Darren, actually. Cause I was like, I could really use his help. And, you know, but I mean, like, you can make fun of me for it, but I was just trying to say, what would the big person in the room do? They get out the chainsaw and cut them down. I appreciate that people want to see. But so what I did in that situation is, you're being a little child who says, I'm going to self-righteously deliver something for you, wash my hands of it, and want to run away. And what I said was, at first I said, do I think I can turn this person around? And then I said, no. And so I said, be the big person in the room. I said, okay, thank you for giving it to me. And I'll take it from here. And you can feel lighter. And so I think that what he's saying here is these, and I get it really from Brad Artson, Rabbi Artson, that, you know, you're going to own it. But when you go to Pharaoh, like, you're going to be the big one in the room. And because Pharaoh is like a child. And, you know, that is what it means to be God to other people.
Yes. Is that still being the big one?
I think it could be.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, right, I mean, it ends up being situational, which is, right, because I just used this example that being the big one in the room was I took something from someone who I felt couldn't do anything with it, or, you know, but that's not true always. So a lot of times you can love someone by still having expectations that they do something. You just have, you know, that's exactly the way God loves us. I mean, God loves us by understanding that we're weak and often petty, but that we also have tremendous goodness in us and tremendous potential. And so God loves us with teachings and commandments because God's love, like you, by love you with still having expectations that you can take responsibility. So I know it's a terrible example, but, you know, I often feel, Lynn and I feel, especially Lynn, that we're just kind of like cooks, like short order cooks for our kids, you know. And I know that you can say just, you know, feed it to them and then let them starve. And I mean, if they don't want to eat it, and eventually they'll eat it. And we might get to the age where, you know, they have to come down at 9 o'clock at night and eat their cold green beans that have been sitting at the dinner table. But at 4 years old and stuff, they're still a little bit before that for us. We don't feel comfortable with that. But, you know, so like mom's like, you know, make me cinnamon toast, you know. And I'm like, oh, my gosh, I have a six-year-old who doesn't know how to make cinnamon toast. And I realized, so what I did was, even though I was tired yesterday, I said, you're going to make cinnamon toast, and I'm going to teach you. Now, sometimes teaching takes more energy than making cinnamon toast, and a lot more cleanup. And I did. And then this morning she came down, and I said, do you want your usual breakfast smoothie? And she's like, yeah. And she's like, no. I want to make cinnamon toast. I'm like, go do it yourself. So then Ziva came down, and who's four, and Rob's like, Ziva, do you want some cinnamon toast? Right? And I was like, oh, great, she's going to make Ziva cinnamon toast. And Ziva said, sure, because she'll do anything Rob wants her to do. And then Rob said, good, I'll show you how to make it. So, like, there are times.
She's a leader.
But what I mean by that is that being the big one in the room, to me, it's a question. You say to yourself, okay, I'm in a situation that's challenging right now. What would it mean to be the big one in the room? And sometimes it does mean I'll be a teacher here, or I'll do more work to help them get to where they need to get. It's not just saying I'll do it for you, but it's the process. I mean, the big question that runs my life is that I think that being the big one in the room is taking ownership. It's taking ownership over the knowledge of what the other person is capable of hearing and understanding. Because no one ever wants to do that. It's amazing to me that we are a speaking animal. So when it says in Genesis, we are made in the image of God, and the rabbis argue, what's this image? Does God have a nose? Is it that we can think? And is it sentience? Is it memory? One of the theories is, no, it's speaking. We're the speaking animal. And God just spoke the world into being. Let it be this, let it be that. The one thing we know that God does is speak. And so, like, and we speak too. So it's language. And it's about the evolution of language. But one of the interesting things is, so here we are. We're speaking creatures. And we speak all the time. And we don't understand what we're saying. And we waste. And, like, most of what people do, and I know because I'm a human being, most of what we do, and I'm doing it right now, is that you speak, and then when another person is speaking, you're just waiting for your turn. Just waiting for your turn. And that's why it's in my sin list, right? The sin, and I think Lynn wrote that one, which is, you know, like, for Yom Kippur, Rosh, it's like, I apologize to God that when I'm in conversation, I'm really just, when the other person is talking, I'm just thinking about what I want to say. And I'm waiting for my turn to say it. I'm not listening. So, like, it's taking ownership over saying, okay, you know, what's Josh able to hear in this moment? What's Lynn able to hear in this moment? What's Ziva able to hear in this moment? What are you all able to hear? You know, when I go on Yom Kippur, I have lots of ideas of things I want to do. And then I say, not just would this be a meaningful topic, but would it just go in one ear and out the other? I would love to give you an entire Yom Kippur sermon just about Abraham Joshua Heschel and what he's telling us the whole world and God is about. But I really think a lot of people would say, like, they're not, it wouldn't, the asimon, the coin in the payphone won't drop. Like, it'll go in one, they'll be like, that was a lot of beautiful quotes about, like, the ineffable relationship we have with God and awe and grandeur and wonder. That's really beautiful stuff. And I'm like, but it wasn't really heard. So, like, I think that it's to take ownership over what is the other person capable of hearing? And then, can I teach? Can I help them get there? You know, because otherwise it's just me talking, and it's not necessarily, it can involve boundaries. It definitely can involve boundaries. And it can involve also that you're not necessarily responsible for bringing everyone to enlightenment. You know, and that's why on Rosh Hashanah, I always tell you, especially if you come Erev Rosh Hashanah, don't forget, one of your jobs on Rosh Hashanah is decide who you want to drop. Right? You can't carry everyone from your whole life. You get to decide that. You don't have to carry everybody. You can say, this friend doesn't understand me more. This sister is just driving me crazy. Right? And I'm not dropping her forever, but I'm dropping her for a year. You know, so, like, I'll rethink it next year. Like, you don't have to be a saint. But in the interactions that you choose to have, when you are in relationship with the people you choose to be in relationship with, then how can you help them go to the next step? So you have to know what they are able of hearing. You have to know, and then you only speak to that. Otherwise, you're just blabbering. And I think that's one of the problems with rabbis and others, which is that they give amazing, they can give amazing sermons much better than mine. But I'm always wondering, like they really think people are, can really hear that, like do that? Like, what's the point? Like, if it's not something that can be heard, why say it? You know, and we run into that situation all the time. When you're struggling with someone, and you're like, look, I'm just going to lay it out. You're asking me to enable this behavior of yours so that because we're in a codependent relationship and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, do they know what enabling is? Do they know what the word? As I told them when we first met, I love the concept of codependency. I only think 1% of the people use the word even know what it means. Right? So I'm like, you're throwing out all this language. Like, oh, you know, I don't want to enable you anymore and this codependent relationship. I'm like, do you even know what any of those words mean? Right? So, like, what's the point of saying them? You know, it would be better just to say, like, I think the fact that you can always call me and complain about your spouse really isn't helping you with your relationship with your spouse. And if they're like, huh? Maybe they can hear that. That's a lot different than saying, I'm enabling our codependent friendship, blah, blah, blah. So, like, I mean, is part of what I think this means, which is if we're a speaking being and you're going to try to be God in this world, you're going to try to channel godliness, then it is, like, what is this person capable of hearing? What would it mean for them to take a step to another level? And then you can say to me, oh, my gosh, that is so, like, patronizing to think that you know what that person's next step is, right? Guilty as charged. Guilty. I think Moses is guilty as charged. Moses is like, I don't want to do that. That is so patronizing for me to say what's good for everybody and the whole future of the world and the elimination of tyranny and slavery on earth, which is all we've ever known. The elimination of tribal justice in favor of a professional justice system. All this, like, rather than saying, no, I think that's what's best for everybody. Like, in other words, I rather think that getting older is kind of owning, yes, I could be wrong. But the fact that I could be wrong won't exempt me from the fact that I'm actually capable of doing this. I'm capable of thinking, what would, because I don't think it's actually that complicated. It requires some life experience and mostly it requires a lot of patience. And it requires a lot of humility and willingness to acknowledge where one has screwed up continually. When you hear someone else screwing up, and you're like, ugh. I mean, it's a compassion. It's like, oh, I've been like that myself. I mean, we know because, like, Marav is so like me. And when Marav is messing up, I'm like, oh, I know she's getting that from me. You know, like, and then I'm like, so I totally know what her next step is. And for me to pretend I don't is just because I don't want to be. You know, and it's true with others. I mean, if you come into my office, say, I want to have a conversation, and, you know, what I usually say to you is, like, Terry, you have more life experience than I do, but if you're asking me for the benefit of my experience, this is what I think. Like, I'm, you know, that's all I expect from anyone else, from my rabbis and my mentors, you know, or anyone. So, like, but I'm willing to, but I would think about, like, from what I know of Terry and what I know about her best self, like, what would that best self hear and want to take another step, you know? And so I just think that we can do it. And the idea that it's self-righteous or you know better, you know, because I remember when I first met Lynn, so she walked out. She said to me, I was in my late 30s, you know, she liked me a lot, and she was very much questioning that, like, whether I was worthy of all of this, like. And one thing she said to me is, like, sometimes you talk, and it's like you know better than I do, right? And I'm like, which is bad for my, that means I was very bad at articulating things in some ways. But I was kind of like, well, I think I do know better than you about some things, and in other things I don't know better than you. But she's like, no, but, you know, like, we're all equal. You know, and I'm like, I guess it really first challenged me. Well, like with my mentor that I had, I mean, and I've had academic mentors and others, but not that many. I wish I'd had more. I mean, I guess my present mentor is sort of Rabbi Artson at the seminary, although I don't only talk to him a couple times a year. But he's there for me if I need him. Like, I'm like, I do think he knows better than I do. And then she's like, well, I don't want a mentor. I'm looking for a boyfriend, you know, or I'm looking for a spouse, you know. And I'm like, but isn't a spouse's role to help you? It's exactly this. I mean, I do weddings, and I always want to quote this. Like, God is appointing you to be God to them. That doesn't mean you go around lecturing them, right? It means that you are an agent of bringing out their best self. And when people come to me and they say things like, oh, my, you know, my spouse drives me crazy, I'm like, yeah, how'd you let that happen? Like, you are God's agent on that. You know what I mean? You just let it all go down the tubes. I mean, like, so in other words, what is your part in the fact that they are, you know, depressed or selfish or you're not connected? You know what I mean? So in that sense, what I was trying to tell them is, I hope I don't, if I sound paternalistic, I really need to rethink what you are capable of hearing. But there's nothing wrong in saying, well, you know, I suffer terribly with depression, and this is something I learned that I think might help you. That's the benefit of my experience. It's not like, oh, you are, thank you, Nadav, oh, so wise one. And I'm like, I obviously didn't say that in a way you could hear. But what I learned with Lynn was how to say things in a way she could hear. And we've, you know, like, I mean, I'm beyond blessed. I mean, like, we have, like, the best marriage in history. Like, so, but it took her a while to figure out, like, it's okay that we can speak to each other that way. It's okay that we can think that. She was so raised with this idea, we're all equal. We're all equal. No one knows better. No one knows better. No one has more, you know, like, it's all demeaning to suggest that you know better. And also, especially if it's a man saying it to a woman. That's, like, horrendous, you know? And I'm like, I could have a mentor as a woman. Like, I'm okay with that. Like, I kind of like it when people know better than I do. I think that's what therapy is. You know, I love therapy. I want someone to be like, you know, I'm going through this crisis and this thing, and it's really bothering me. And the therapist turns to me and be like, oh, drama. Like, you're making a mountain out of a molehill. And I am? And you're like, yeah, you are. Let it go. Okay. Like, I mean, how dare they know better than I? That's what a therapist is. You know what I mean? So, like, I think that we have to get out of that idea that no one, but if you are going to take on the role of thinking that you know what can help somebody, and if you know how to get someone from point A to point B, one step higher, then own it. Like, own that you're doing it. Own that you have to figure out what they're capable of hearing. And you may have to reframe the message a million times, you know, or give up. Or say, you know what, I can't be an agent of God's you. You know what I mean? I got to turn you back over to the universe. You know, I mean, I don't know. You have a friend who's alcoholic or something like that. You think you can help and you work and you work and you work and you work or something. And then you realize, you know what? I can't be God's agent here. Like, I must be the wrong messenger. And then you turn it over. You're like, I can't. You know, I've tried. You know, and you could say that Moses didn't speak the language that Pharaoh could hear. But actually, I think the solving of the hardening of heart issue is that he actually did. Like, he knew that Pharaoh had to resist it and resist it and resist it until Pharaoh could hear it. Like, he actually, God did know what Pharaoh needed. If Pharaoh had let them go earlier, Pharaoh had not gotten the message. And so that it's the process that happens. I can hear from questions and responses that being the big one in the room could be construed by you as turning the other cheek, of taking it, of accepting something. Because you said, Rabbi, let them have the parking spot. And that is turning the other cheek. That's saying, oh, if you need it so much, you take it. If someone needs something from me, I'd let them have it because, someone has to be the big one in the room. But that's not necessarily the case. In some cases, it's true. It means being the big person in the room is, in a sense, walking away and saying, fine, you know, you can have it. But it perhaps is better understood, again quoting Rabbi Bradley Shavit Artson, on being God to others, is to think of yourself as someone's parent. It is paternalistic. And again, yeah, we have these problems. I shouldn't. We're all equal. No. That's not. The demand that we're all equal is not exactly the way to think of it. It's okay in a situation to think of yourself for your own space in between your reacting and your finding a way to properly act. Acting is a case of will. Reacting is not a case of will. It is just an automatic reaction. And what you insert in between there is, if I'm to be an agent of God, if I'm going to bring God's presence into the world, as the Kaddish says, in these relationships. An exercise can be, I'm going to think of myself as this person's parent. So I'll give you an example. I don't think there's a place for expressed anger in parenting. You can express judgment. You can express punishment. You can express correction. But anger within that is almost never needed. And we can think of extreme examples, and I'm thinking of this kind of like shouting to make sure your child doesn't walk in the street, right? Although I don't know if that counts as anger, but it's certainly raising one's voice. The truth is we should save those kinds of actions for those kinds of emergencies. But in general, I want to, as a parent, I want to react to something my child has done. But as a parent, I stop and I say, how do I make this correction? How do I express that what they did was not okay without anger? And in the vast majority of the cases, the anger decreases the power of your message. So, I mean, any parent has noticed this, that in, and it's a Jewish value, in almost all cases, it's with a quiet voice that you are heard. And so, yes, I don't know, your child hits the other child. Instead of shouting, which I want to do, my reaction is to yell their name and yell that they're in timeout and yell for them to go. And I've done it. It's not an expression of God. To be God to her is to, or to your son or whoever, is to stop and say, and to walk over. And in a way, quietly, sometimes I put my hand on their shoulder, which is a very good thing when you're showing caring. And you say, now, you're going to go in timeout now because hitting your sister is not an acceptable behavior. And this is the way it's going to work. And you say it very, very quietly. So this way of being a parent is also true in other relationships. I mean, if it means, so let's say you are in a situation where someone has angered you publicly in some way, well, in the world, or an in-law, or a sibling, or a parent, can you quietly say, look, you know, that I don't think that was really helpful. You're asking yourself, what is this person capable of hearing? And when you ask that self your question, think of it also as, what would a parent help this person to learn? I use the example of a therapist. I sometimes think, what would a therapist say to that person? We've all been trained to think of therapists as just these listeners, like these martyrish listeners. But actually, a good therapist is someone that basically waits for their moments to then wait for a moment when you can hear, right? I don't know. You've talked for four sessions about your mom, but they sense that, I mean, that this is time for them to, they've heard something in what you've said, that they can think of something to say to you you may be able to hear, right? They're not just your best friend who listens to complain about life. If they do, they're not a good therapist, because in a sense they are enabling the continuation of the complaining. But they may have to wait till you talk yourself out, which is something my therapist did for me, which was wonderful. Sometimes you just have to wait till the person's talked out. They're not condoning it by saying, oh yeah, tell me more. Oh yeah, your mom's so bad to you. Oh, she should have been there at your recital when you were little. No, they're just listening, but they choose their moment. And like a parent putting their hand on your shoulder and saying, if they know what you can hear that will take you to the next step, they do that. You always have to think of Hillel's famous dictum that don't do unto others what you would find obnoxious for them to do to you. If you are paternalistic in an obnoxious way, you are going to scare them away. I don't like it when people try to be my therapist or people try to be my parent. If you're noticing it, then the person's being obnoxious. If it's transparent, I mean, if it's invisible and transparent, then it can be very, very helpful, right? It could be as simple as you have someone working for you and they don't react well to criticism, but they're not doing well. And one of the things you might say is, I really liked it when you were with that customer or that client. I loved it when you did that thing. And you're basically teaching them like a parent
a good behavior that they did, that they could continue. And their ego is not offended. They're able to hear that because you just gave them a compliment, right? We all do this, and some of us are better than others, and we need to practice it more. But that's being a parent in a situation to another. And so in this sense, one could say, Rabbi, I have a problem with what you said about your relationship with your wife, that when you first met, you know, you were trying to be your therapist or trying to be these other things. And you would be right to object to that. And she was right, in a sense, to say, you're not my therapist, you're my partner, you're my boyfriend, you're my spouse. That's true. I'm not a professional therapist, and I don't want to be a professional therapist to her, and I should say it differently, but it's this, which is, if you do have a way to heal another person or lead them to their higher self, your job, it's not wrong to think of your job as, what would a therapist do here? What would a parent do here? Right? Because this is a place where this other person is trapped, or they're vulnerable, or they have a reaction and a bad behavior that's not helping them. And I can see that. To be God's agent is to say, not, hey, I'm going to be your therapist, so I'm so wise, and I think you should do this, because they'll react and run the other way. So you've basically been the opposite of God. You've served as an agent against the will of God. So that's the fine line. You're not their therapist, you're not their parent. But in your spiritual practice, to think of yourself, what would a parent do here? So someone once said to me, you know, my mother-in-law is driving me crazy. I hear what you're saying. You're saying, oh, just let her drive you crazy and not say anything. No, I'm not saying it's not necessarily true that you would have to be a martyr, but you're saying, what would my mother-in-law's own mother, you know, handle this? In a way, it's an exercise to help me think, what is she capable of hearing? You know, if she is in a trapped place, a wounded place, a reactive place, is there anything I can do that would take her to another level, like with an employee? Is there anything I could say to help her see it differently? And that's very different than getting down in the trenches with them, like at their level, and be like, well, look, I'm just going to tell you that you haven't read the latest article in the paper, and you're dead wrong about what the way you say how to treat the grandkids. That's just getting down to their level. And so that's a clarification. It doesn't necessarily mean be a martyr, but to say to yourself, between reaction and divine or holy action, how can I be? What would their own parents say if they had the best parent in the world?